This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One of the main reasons for overuse of chemicals in vineyards is to try to increase production. But the problem with that is that grapes from low production vineyards make better wine.
You're planning a nice dinner party and you want to buy a bottle of wine. How do you stay true to your environmental commitment when choosing a wine? Do you need to buy organic wine, or are there other factors that are more significant? And what about the cork? Does it matter what stops the bottle up? Today on Sea Change Radio, we explore wine, what goes in the bottle, and what seals it. First, we talk with winemaker Christopher Vandendriesch, who discusses practices in the industry that do and don't promote sustainability, and how his small family-run winery, White Rock, works to conserve natural resources while producing excellent-tasting wine. Next, we talk with environmental journalist and educator Andrew Revkin, who's been leading a documentary filmmaking project on the sustainability of cork. We talk about cork and the movement towards synthetic corks and aluminum screw tops. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Christopher Vandendriesch. He's the owner and winemaker at White Rock Vineyards in Napa, California. Christopher, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
First, give our listeners a little bit of a background on White Rock. It's not one of the best known brands, and you're a small winemaker, a family-owned winery. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of White Rock?
Sure. White Rock was one of the original old wineries in Napa. It was originally planted to grapes in the 1860s, and it survived as a winery until Prohibition, at which point they stopped producing grapes. So we bought the property in 1977. My father bought it, and we spent the next few years replanting the vineyards, and then we started making wine in 1985. So we revived the old ghost winery, White Rock Vineyards, of the same name, to White Rock Vineyards as it is today.
And how many cases do you produce compared to, let's say, a Kendall Jackson or a Mondavi?
Oh, about 1% of what they make.
What does a major winery like a Kendall Jackson produce?
A bigger winery is making on the order of 200 to 500,000 cases, and White Rock makes about 2,000 to 2,500 cases.
And your price range for your wines are usually in what? Just give us an idea of the price retail in a wine shop.
In the $30 to $50 range.
And is your claret your best known label?
Well, the claret is the wine that we've been making the longest. But now we make two red blends, two Cabernet Sauvignon blends. The claret is the Bordeaux style blend, and then we make a more of a Napa style Cabernet blend called Laureate.
And do you grow all your own grapes, or do you bring grapes from other growers in the region?
We grow 100% of our own grapes on our 135-acre property.
Wow. And this is not organically certified wine, but you use very similar methods. Maybe you can tell us the difference between what you do and the process that would go into organic certification.
Well, the organic certification is somewhat complicated, or rather it's confusing. There's a couple different types of organics. You could have organic wine, which one sees a lot in lower-priced wines in supermarkets. It doesn't allow the use of sulfur in the making of the wine. The other classification is the wine made from organic grapes. So farming the vineyard organically, but then the winemaking allows the use of sulfur dioxide.
And without sulfur dioxide, you're not going to be looking at like a 1940 vintage wine being worth its salt. Is that right?
Correct. The wines don't age very well when there's no sulfur used in the processing.
You grow it for consumption within a year or two, generally. Is that correct?
Generally true. There are exceptions to the rule.
Your grape growing process is
pesticide-free, but you use sulfites in the winemaking to...
It protects against spoilage and prepares the wine for longer aging in the bottle.
But that prohibits you from getting an organic certification, is that correct?
We wouldn't be able to call it organic wine, but we could still call it wine made from organic grapes.
Maybe highlight some of the differences between the organic winemaking process and just general sustainable practices.
They're quite different because organic is a very strict code of rules about exactly which products can be used in a vineyard or in a winery. It can be very dogmatic and doesn't necessarily work in all circumstances. The sustainability is simply the idea that whatever you do, you're smart about how you do it, and that you do it in a way that has the lowest impact on your environment. And you do it in a way that allows you to conceive of continuing your farming for the next 100 years. One of the things about White Rock that I feel so proud of being part of is that we can look back at a vineyard that has been producing grapes since the, for more than a century ago. And we can look forward to another century of wine growing. And we have to think about how we're going to treat the land so the land will be continuing to grow first quality grapes.
The standards are like some of the more difficult things for these growers to jump through. Even if they are trying to do the right thing, they may not have the deepest pockets to try to get organically certified. It's not like you're getting organic chocolate or organic red peppers, and then they think, oh, organic wine must be just as good as organic beef. It's a very different beast, right?
Well, I mean, on the organics, for example, in the vineyard, relies heavily on an old school traditional pesticide, copper sulfate. But copper sulfate is actually quite toxic to the soil, and it stays in the soil for a long time. And its long-term use does cause the vineyard to produce less and less fruit. So biodynamics and organics use a lot of this copper sulfate to the detriment of the vineyard and the environment.
Explain the toxicity a little bit more.
It's toxic to soil microbes. The microbes in soil are a very important part of what makes organically grown grapes better. If you're in a region where you need to use a lot of copper sulfate in order to be an organic grower, you're actually killing the microbes that you're supposed to be relying on to make better wine. The complexity of the microflora in the soil, the microfauna in the soil, are those little bacteria and yeast and nematodes and worms and things are actually breaking down the rock, the soil, and making it water soluble so that it can be absorbed by the vine and incorporated into the juice, into the grapes. A dead soil that's either had too much copper sulfate or too much Roundup or too much of any kind of a chemical spray won't have that complexity and populations of things living in the soil. And so the resulting wine will be that much simpler, less mineral, less expressive of that particular soil's impact on the wine.
That much closer to Welch's.
That much closer to Welch's. So copper sulfate, if you're in a vineyard that requires a lot of copper sulfate to keep the vines from getting mildew, for example, then your wine, the environment, all would be better off if you could use a targeted mildicide that was a systemic chemical that was properly researched to create no other problems in the environment. You'd be much better off using that than using copper sulfate, but then you could not call your wine organic.
We've heard a lot recently in the news about Apple's supply chain problems with the iPhone, and there's just so many parts that go into labor all across the world. But this is simpler, I imagine. You have a neighbor who has a surplus of grapes in, Cabernet Franc or whatever, and you decide to add that to that year's varietal. What kind of standards would they have to meet, and what kind of transparency is there when vineyards are sourcing grapes from other places?
It's very difficult to know exactly what people use because every farmer wants to have a good-looking crop, and when it's 11 o'clock at night and they have a problem to deal with, they're going to use whatever they have to make their crop look good, and they won't necessarily tell you later on. That's one of the reasons that at White Rock Vineyards we only use our own grapes. However, when I have worked with other people's grapes for other brands, I have found I have asked very specific questions of the farmer as to what products were being used. It's actually quite important as a winemaker to know which products were used, because some of these products have an effect on the fermentation. They could have an effect on, they could slow or stop a fermentation before it's finished, or they can have an effect on byproducts created during the fermentation. And some fertilizers, for example, will change the levels of nutrients in the juice. And there's various byproducts that too many or not enough nutrients could also cause during a fermentation. So I would tend to stay away from a vineyard that was over-fertilized with high nitrogen fertilizers. High nitrogen fertilizers are used in conventional agriculture to try to bump up your production and make more pounds per acre. One of the main reasons for overuse of chemicals in vineyards is to try to increase production. But the problem with that is that grapes from low production vineyards make better wine. So not only do you have lower quality wine if you overproduce, but then you're forcing the vines through a use of much more chemicals to do so. So you have a wine with less flavor and a chemical load that may cause problems.
Just a wine, oh, love my wine. Make it matter, chef, as ever, doggone time. Give me wine, wine, wine. All the time, time, time. 'Cause when I drink it, I feel so doggone fine. Give me wine, wine, wine. All the time, time, time. Give me wine, wine, wine. All the time, time, time. 'Cause when I get it, feel so doggone fine. Well, a little bit of wine is never bad. People drink wine to keep the feeling sad. Give me wine, wine, wine. All the time, time, time. 'Cause when I get it.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the owner and winemaker of White Rock Vineyards, Christopher Vandendriesch. Some of these larger industrial scale wines, what are some of the ingredients that consumers should know about and may not know about?
Conventionally farmed grapes, like any conventionally farmed produce or a meat, will have small residuals of all the pesticides and herbicides. Some may even be hormone-related products that will almost certainly be in the final product. In the case of wine, where there's a fermentation after the grapes are grown, those products may also affect the fermentation and could cause things to be created during the fermentation that could cause a headache, for example, in the situation like the histamine production in wines. A nice clean fermentation doesn't really have any histamine production, so the wine has no histamines. However, if there's stress factors, and some of those stress factors could be chemicals used in the vineyard, that could encourage the growth or the production of, say, histamines in the wine.
So Christopher, your family's been growing grapes and making wine since the late 70s. Walk us through how your sustainable practices have evolved over the last 3.5 decades.
Well, I think for White Rock Vineyards, for my family, sustainability evolved naturally from the fact that we were living in the vineyard. And as kids, we played amongst the vines and picked the grapes ourselves. There's sustainability, in our case, simply refers to being smart about the inputs that you make into the vineyard, being smart about the effect that you have on the environment, making sure that your runoff isn't damaging a local watershed, or that you're not creating any air pollutants or water pollution. Sustainability also would include conserving water, because we all know that water is a scarce commodity. And then it involves the taking care of your workers. Essentially, it's something that if you care about where you're working and you live with it on a daily basis, it comes naturally. Nowadays, we, as an industry, so many people have farmed unsustainably, producing a lot of pollutants, using lots of inputs, too much water, that we realize as an industry it's time for us to come together and try to help those people that haven't been farming sustainably.
Tell us about some of the group efforts that are underway in your region of California.
We have an industry group called the California Sustainable Wine Growers that is working to convince bigger companies to use sustainable methods, essentially limiting water use, limiting the fertilizer use, because we all know that fertilizers are a main pollutant in water. finding ways to divert runoff, reduce erosion in the vineyards, and perhaps avoid the use of something like pesticides or herbicides by changing your trellising system in the vineyard or your cultural techniques in the vineyard. And then in the winery, sustainability would include perhaps using solar power either for electricity or for hot water. We have a cave at White Rock Vineyards. Our winery is a functioning cave winery. There's no heating or cooling or humidification in the building. So that's a major step towards a sustainable building, a natural building that does not require any refrigeration or humidification.
And what about reuse? You talk about trying to cut down on your carbon footprint with your cave and restricting your water use, but what about reusing the byproducts from the winemaking process?
Well, one of the one main byproduct that we have in the wine business are the skins and seeds of the grapes after the fermentation is complete. That can be up to 15% of your harvest tonnage. So at White Rock, we produce about 15 tons worth of these seeds and skins and stems after the harvest. And traditionally in the business, people have brought them to a landfill. What we've always done at White Rock is to mix those skins and seeds with organic steer manure and make our own compost. So we have compost piles on the property that sit for a year as they turn themselves into delicious fertilizer that we can use in the vineyard.
Christopher Vandendriesch, owner and winemaker of White Rock Vineyards. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andy Revkin. He helped found the environmental news section for The Times, is currently the Senior Fellow for Environmental Understanding at Pace University, as well as still writing a blog for the New York Times, the .earth blog at newyorktimes.com. Andy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you.
So you and your class at Pace have been doing some interesting research into wine corks. Can you tell us a little bit more about what stimulated the idea and some of the findings?
While I was still at the Times, I was always fascinated by this issue. Cork forests of Southern Europe were starting to get converted into other uses as the cork industry, which turns out to be a multi-billion dollar industry, just putting corks in bottles. The wine industry was starting to shift a bit toward screw tops and synthetic corks. And in the late 2000s, there was a push by the cork industry to sort of to note the sustainable harvest of cork that is the basis for that product since the Egyptians first stuck a piece of cork into a bottle has been one of the ways to seal a beverage. And now I teach this course at Pace every spring. It's a documentary production course where the students go somewhere and shoot a film. And with my involvement, it's a film on some issue related to sustainable human advancement. Last year, we looked at efforts to cut environmental impacts from shrimp farming in Belize. And this year, we decided to pursue this cork story. So we're following the story from the wine cellar of a fancy restaurant near New York to Portugal, where the students will go next month, and to look at the issue up close. And it's been fascinating. The cork harvests are sustainable. It's like the rubber tappers in the Amazon, who I wrote about back in 1990. They're harvesting a product from trees without killing the trees. But the industry has grown so much that actually that harvest has gotten more intense. We just learned this a couple of days ago that there's some cork forests where the cycle of taking the tree bark has been accelerated. So it's a shorter period between harvests. So you can see even within the industry, there's pressures like that. But the jury is still out in the sense that the reporting by this team is still underway. We'll have more to say, later this spring, but it's fun.
Well, I can imagine the perks of being able to go to Belize last year, and now they get to go to Portugal. They they've definitely come up with some nice vacation spots for their research. I applaud the Pace students for their entrepreneurial efforts.
Well, what's fun about this? The professor who conceived this course 10 years ago figured out a way to make use of that spring break, where students normally go and just sit on a beach somewhere and drink. And she's kind of turned that into an experience where they go somewhere and make a film and have a little relaxation, too, when they're done with the shooting.
Sure. It sounds like a good deal. So there has been a movement underfoot for the last decade or so to get away from cork for a number of reasons. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about why winemakers have been moving away from cork.
The cork industry started treating the corks at a certain point with a process involving chlorine, and it could leave a compound in the cork that could be tasted or smelled in the wine. And so this was a big issue. Then there's also premature oxidation, premox they call it, which is where too much oxygen gets in if a cork shrinks or if, you know, there's porosity there. So many wine vintners will use the cork is sort of the oxidation that occurs as part of the process of making the wine. It's literally, but it can happen at a pace that's not appropriate. So there's screw tops that have kind of a plastic valve in them that gives you just the right amount of oxidation and doesn't come with the TCA is the shorthand for the chemical. Then there are synthetic plastic stoppers as well. But there are issues for the wine industry in terms of not having had those around for more than a decade. The question is, do they have any long-term impacts as well? And then there's just the basic sustainability question. Aluminum is a energy-intense metal to make, so the aluminum screw top and comes with impacts and costs, and the same with the other materials. So there's all these trade-offs between the quality of the wine, the cost of the product, the appearance, and the marketability. There's definitely still a consumer bias toward cork, especially the higher end of the market. So it's an interesting story. You give me a cure out from New Orleans. Now that's a recipe I sure do need. Some cider vinegar and some elderberry wine.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with environmental journalist Andrew Revkin. So why don't they have cork trees like this in California or Missouri? Why is the industry so concentrated in the cork-making region of Spain and Portugal, the Iberian Peninsula?
Well, from what I understand and what the students have learned so far, there's a species of tree. It's a cork oak that is indigenous to those regions, southern Europe, essentially, southwestern Europe and North Africa, Morocco. And that's where it is. Now, I actually don't know if it's been exported and whether you have cork plantations anywhere else in the world. That's a good question. I'll ask the students to check that out.
So maybe walk us through from when somebody harvests the cork from a tree in Portugal to when we open it at a dinner party or something.
Well, you have a landowner who has property that has these trees. They'll make an agreement with the harvesters who come in periodically to harvest the cork from the trees. And again, it's kind of like tapping a rubber tree or maple syrup, you know, maple sap from a maple sugar maple. And that is then taken to factories that process it into the corks we know. And again, as I was saying, there was a point when those corks started to be treated to avoid contamination. And that's what led to some of the pushback against cork. But there's a higher quality cork that doesn't have these problems. And finding the right mix there of processes is part of what we'll be looking at as well. And then again, then it goes into the wine, and the wine goes into a, it gets aged or not, or depending on what variety of wine you're talking about, and ends up on a shelf in your local store or restaurant.
And a lot of us have noticed some nice cork art in a restaurant where they take it and they'll take thousands of corks and put them in some kind of a pattern under glass. And so you see corks being reused. But have your students learned anything about how corks are managed by most waste management companies when they're put into the recycle bin?
Well, what they are learning, there is an effort to recycle corks. You know, where it's ground up and reutilized as cork, whether it's in flooring or some other materials. So, and it's, you know, so it's handled as a separate waste stream, but that has to be done if it gets mixed in with, you know, other garbage or other recyclables, it becomes problematic. It's just something that happens at restaurants and where they flow it back. There's a website called recork.org. which is worth listeners visiting if they want to learn more about the recycling process.
Great. I don't know if your students have found patterns, but are there certain wine regions, countries that are more prone to getting away from cork or just
yes.
using cork? Maybe, like, you know, there's winemaking we associate just with, a lot of people just think of it as France and California, but there's dozens of important winemaking regions in the world now.
From what we understand, cork is still by far the dominant material. New Zealand is a place where for quite a long time, some of the leading vintners there have been using screw tops. And they're selling, you know, high quality wines. So this isn't your, you know, $5 or $10 bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be a market for serious wine that comes with another kind of closure. But for the most part, it's still the norm, including U.S. wineries. I've heard of some, the Willamette area, Oregon. There are wineries there that had moved to synthetics, although there's at least one there we've heard about that's moved from back to cork now that they've resolved some of these problems with this TCA.
I can imagine that maybe in New Zealand or some other countries that there is less of a stigma attached with the screw tops as opposed to here, where we think of anything with a screw top is usually categorized in consumers' mind as cheap wine.
Yeah, and again, there is a significant element of this that is about marketing and consumer preference. And it takes time and education for wine drinkers to start to appreciate that good wines can come with a different kind of a top on them. What's been really exciting about this course moving forward is that it shows the potential of students to do creative, concrete content creation, a lot of C's there, and become part of the discourse on important issues. There's a NYU, the New York University Journalism Program, has a really interesting initiative that I also point to often called explainer.net. It's a website called explainer.net where they generate explanatory videos using unusual means to convey complicated ideas. And one of the recent ones was a music video that explains the fracking process and issues related to fracking that I thought was particularly successful. So students are able to dive in, get in the game, and become a meaningful part of public discourse on issues, whether it's sustainable food and drink or where we get our energy from.
Andy Revkin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Anytime.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Isaac Hayes, Floyd Dixon, and the Rolling Stones. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others.
and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.